Hello, today is Monday, February 23rd, 2015. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and you're listening to the Literary New England Radio Show, where tonight we'll delve into the minds and pages of three terrific writers as we talk with Andrea Chapin on The Tutor, Elliot Ackerman on Green on Blue, and Holly LaCroix on The Half-Brother. As we talk with each author, we'll also be giving away copies of their novels, so listen for your chance to reach out to us and win. If you can't stay with us until the end of the show, you don't have to miss anything, because the Literary New England Radio Show can be downloaded anytime as an iTunes podcast or streamlined from the Literary New England Radio Show archives. You can also keep track of the Literary New England Radio Show on Facebook and Twitter. So if you don't like or follow us already, please do. In fact, if you become a new Literary New England Twitter follower this week, between now and February 28th, I'll put your name into a hat to win a copy of Ellen Hildebrand's The Matchmaker, which just came out in paperback. A Massachusetts resident, we've had Ellen on the show several times, and you can find our interviews with her in our archives. So follow us at Lit New England, and a copy of The Matchmaker could be yours. Author Holly LaCroix lives outside of Boston. She's a Georgia native, a former Pushcart Prize nominee, the author of the 2010 novel The Swimming Pool, and the author of The Half-Brother that was released this month, and for which Holly is having a launch party tomorrow night, Tuesday, February 24th, at Newtonville Books in Newton Center, Massachusetts at 7 p.m. Set at a New England boarding school, The Half-Brother has been called a stirring, melancholy tale of families and the secrets they dare not share. A passionate, provocative story of complex family bonds and the search for identity. But this is how Holly explains it.
So The Half-Brother is, to me, it's really a story of identity and how we form our identities. My protagonist is a man named Charlie Garrett, who is an English teacher at a boarding school. He falls in love, as a very young man, he falls in love with a woman who starts out as his student, but then their relationship starts, she's no longer a student, so that's okay. And this is really the relationship that is going to open him up as a person. He's a very buttoned up kind of guy from a broken home, a very complicated family background. But then that relationship has to end for reasons that I can't reveal here. Years later, this woman, May, comes back to the same school to be a teacher herself. And that same year, his half-brother, to whom he's always compared himself in a sort of Cain and Abel way, himself being Cain and his golden brother being Abel, the good brother, he comes to the school to teach also. And Charlie pushes these two together into a relationship as a kind of atonement in his own kind of complicated way, and so now we have this love triangle, and of course this leads to many complications. So that's the spine of the book, but it's really this relationship between these two brothers and how Charlie sees himself and how he's able to finally, at a very late age, come of age.
So Holly, where did the story idea come from?
That's a really good question. I worked on the book for a very long time. It was actually my first book, my book that I put in a drawer. And I worked on it for years, and then I finally put it aside, and I wrote my official first book, The Swimming Pool. But something about this story kept kept attracting me. And my two brothers, Charlie and Nick, were originally three characters. And then over time, they sort of morphed into two. And then one day, I woke up and I said, and it was really like this, I did just sort of have this revelation. One day, I said, oh, they're brothers. And that, which I hadn't known, and that suddenly opened up the book to me. And but where the story came from, I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, did you go to a school like this?
I did not. I did go to a private school, and I had some extraordinary teachers who I thank in my acknowledgments. And there is a great deal in the book about teaching, and that was really fun for me. That was the only real research I did, because I went and sat in on some high school English classes of some amazing teachers I know up here, and just to remind myself what it's like, what those classroom dynamics are like, what relationships are like between a teacher and a student, what can happen. I'm not talking in any kind of sexual way, but just, you know, it can be very intense. And
sure.
So I experienced some wonderful teachers along the way. So, but I did not go to a boarding school. I had to just imagine that. And I've never been a teacher except for a very brief period. So I had to imagine that too.
I love it how so many boarding school stories are set in New England, because it seems like the perfect place on so many levels. I mean, there's a lot of awesome, really old boarding schools in this area that just are seeped in history, and these awesome buildings where, I don't know, it just seems like anything can happen, good or bad. And I'm wondering, did you ever consider setting the book somewhere else other than New England?
I didn't think about setting it elsewhere. I mean, so I'm a Southerner, and Charlie's a Southerner, but I've lived up here for almost 30 years, which is amazing to me. And but the thing about this transplanted Southerner thing is you're essentially a stranger in a strange land. So you can see your surroundings, I think, with a clarity that natives don't. And so there's that attraction of taking somebody and putting them in a slightly foreign environment. And the South and the North are quite different. And as far as the boarding school thing goes, it's interesting. It's been a really nice surprise to me to think of this as a boarding school book, believe it or not, because it is a book about the teachers. It's about adults. And so as I was writing it, I wasn't thinking I'm writing a boarding school book. You know, I wasn't thinking about Catcher in the Rye or whatever. And although it is, in its own way, it is a coming-of-age story, as I mentioned, but it's about this teacher who's a very, very late bloomer. But I think that the attraction for a writer of a boarding school book is that you do have this enclosed society, this enclosed environment, and so it's this petri dish of intense feelings and relationships, and sort of that outside world noise is muted at a boarding school. So I think that's
one of
the attractions.
I love that, what you just said, and you've gotten great reviews for The Half-Brother. Booklist gave it a starred review, and you were even compared to Pat Conroy and Donna Tartt, two very different writers, but two very incredible writers. How are you feeling about the reaction to The Half-Brother?
Well, that was pretty wonderful, I have to say, being compared to those writers. And it's always really wonderful when you feel like a reviewer gets it. And I'm trying very hard this time around. I told my editor and my agent I don't want to read reviews, but of course I'm going to read them. In the age of the internet, you can't avoid them. So I have seen them, and especially I've seen the good ones because they have to go on my website and things like that. But that particular book riot, what I mean, there is, you know, I do write plot, but I don't think I write pot boilers. And as a Southerner, I'm really steeped in this tradition of of plot of Greek tragedy and of myth and of the Bible, which is all plot. And you think about Southern writers like Robert Penn Warren and Faulkner, and they wrote beautifully, but they had plot. And plot has become sort of unfashionable. It's become sort of a marker of downmarket fiction, which is so funny to me. But all the writers that were mentioned in that Book Riot review are very big on plot, which so that made me happy that they compare. Of course, I'm happy to be compared to those writers, but also that they grasped that aspect of it, that plot is not a dirty word. Yeah.
So you mentioned before how you're from the South. You're from Georgia. You're from Atlanta.
Yeah.
You're a transplant up here to New England. Now you live outside of Boston. There seems to me to be a real mystique around Southern writers. They're lush. They tell these certain types of stories. Do you categorize yourself as a certain type of writer, whether it be in a category according to geography or genre or anything else?
I really don't. I actually wouldn't mind being classified as a Southern writer because, as you said, Southern writers are just so fabulous. But I don't know if I get to claim that anymore since I've lived up here for so long. I do. I feel like I take aspects of a number of traditions, but definitely that Southern storytelling tradition. As I said, not being afraid of plot, not being afraid of twists of fate. But at the same time, I am kind of fascinated by this buttoned up Yankee culture. This sort of Cheever-esque take on life, which is becoming more and more rare. You know, that's, I think, the golden age of boarding schools, or maybe not the golden age, but the peak age of boarding schools ended probably in the early 60s when suddenly the culture shifted. And I certainly wouldn't want to go back to that, but that kind of, you know, very, very manners conscious, buttoned up culture is interesting to me because it means there are a lot of secrets. And Southern culture is different in that it is frankly more gracious and more seemingly more open, but very, very concerned with appearances. And so there are secrets there too. So those are the similarities between those two. And it's rich ground for a writer.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Now, today, Monday, February 23rd, as this show airs live for the first time, you are at a reading and signing with the fabulous fiction writer, James Scott.
Yes.
And tomorrow you're having your launch party.
Yes. I'm very excited.
And tell us about that. That's going to be at Newtonville Books in Massachusetts.
Yes, Newtonville Books, which is my hometown store, and I am the owners, Jamie Clark and Mary Cotton, are good friends of mine, and actually Jamie read this book in manuscript and helped with it and was one of my early readers, and he's in the acknowledgments, and I cannot tell you how lucky I feel to have this as a neighborhood store. So the launch is there, and it's a party. It's open to all. We will have drinks and eat, and we'll celebrate. So, and just cross your fingers that there's no snow.
No.
It doesn't get canceled. But we are really excited about it over here. So, and I'm really excited to be at Odyssey with Jim Scott, who is also a fabulous writer. His first book, The Kept, has done extremely well. And he lives out there now. He used to live in Boston. He lives out there in central Massachusetts, which is where The Half-Brother is set. So I'm especially glad to go out there. And the Odyssey bookstore actually chose The Half-Brother for their first editions book club selection for February, which is a huge honor.
Huge honor. So.
Well, yay! Good for you.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you have a terrific website, which is hollylacroix.com. Is that the best place for people to go to learn about you, Holly, and see where you're going to be? Because you're going to be a lot of places over the next several months.
Yes, yes. No, I try to keep it updated. I'm trying really hard to learn WordPress, but I have people also to help me. So, yes, everything is there, hollylacroix.com. There's an events page that's got it all listed. And I've also got a blog and news page where I put in everything that's coming up. I've been doing a lot of interviews, and I've written pieces that have appeared here and there, so I post them there. So it's all there. I am going down south for you Southerners. I'm going to Atlanta on the 26th, which is this coming Thursday. And then a couple weeks after that, the second week of March, I will be in at Parnassus, which is Ann Patchett's bookstore in Nashville. And then I will be at Quail Ridge Books, which is in Raleigh. And then I'll be at Malaprops, which I've heard is one of the greatest bookstores in the universe, at in Asheville, North Carolina.
So now you have two books out there sitting on bookstore shelves. How does that feel like? Is this how you had hoped that your life or your career would turn out, that someday you would walk into your local independent bookstore and you would see a couple of Holly LaCroix novels, if not more than a couple, sitting there waiting for people to scoop up?
That's a really wonderful question. And yes, the answer is yes. I would say it's interesting at a certain point. For a while, of course, it was just a pie in the sky thing. But when I realized I really wanted to be a writer, a very strong sense came to me of what it was going to be like to hold my own book in my hand. And even though I tend to be filled with self-doubt on all fronts, something, I had a very strong gut feeling that it was going to happen. And someday I was going to be holding this book that I had written in my hand. It happened about 10 years after I thought it would, but, you know, that's life.
Well, and what is this? That's life. Tell us just a little bit before we wrap things up about your writing life. Do you write every day, and are you working on another book?
I do write every day. I'm working on another book that I'm really excited about, and it's very funny because I think it's a little bit like, although not nearly as glamorous, but it's a little bit like actors promoting movies. You know, they're promoting a movie that they wrapped a year ago, and they're already deep into some other project, and then you have to go backward and remember that project. And it's the same with a book. I'm now into my next book, and that's what's really creatively firing me right now. But it's really nice to go back and look at the half other. So anyway, so yes, I do write every day. I'm transitioning. I have three kids who are rapidly growing up and leaving the house. And so I used to have to completely orient my writing life around that. And now suddenly I have a lot more time, which is wonderful. So I'm you know, adapting my schedule and figuring out how to live and with more space, which is really lovely. I've been a writer really since my late 20s, but I had three kids and that took up some time and was a bit of a distraction.
That is a bit of a joyous distraction.
Yes, yes.
In one or two sentences, why should someone pick up the half brother?
I adore Charlie. He is a character, I think, full of heart. He's deeply flawed. He's not always a reliable narrator, but he has a really interesting perspective on the world, and I think readers will be able to identify with him and will want to know how his story proceeds and ends. So I think a book is always about the characters, really, and not that all characters have to be likable, but they have to be people you want to follow. And for me, Charlie is someone I want to follow.
I agree. I love it. I think that was about 13 to 15 sentences, but I'll take it anyway.
Sorry.
Sounds great.
Holly, yes. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, the launch party for the Half-Brother will take place tomorrow night, Tuesday, February 24th at 7 p.m. at Newtonville Books in Massachusetts. All are welcome to drop by, learn more about Holly and where she's going to be by visiting her website, which is www.hollylacroix.com. Win a copy of The Half-Brother right now by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Elliot Ackerman is the author of Green on Blue, a debut novel named one of Amazon's best books of the month for February. Elliot is also a journalist, a former Marine, member of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, a former White House fellow, and a man living and working out of Istanbul. He's an individual who has accomplished and been awarded for so much that I really wasn't sure how to best introduce him on the show, so I asked him to tell me how he tends to describe himself.
I consider myself a writer, and I write, as you mentioned, I write in different veins. I write fiction, both short fiction and novels. I also write, reportage, some of the essays you may have seen. In the past, I've done a variety of work from being a military officer for a number of years to also doing work in the U.S. government. But I would describe myself as a writer, just with a varied past.
A writer with a varied past. I love that. That's a great description. And so now Green on Blue, which was just named one of Amazon's best books of the month, is your brand new novel. Have you always been a fiction writer, even while you were doing all of these other things?
Yeah, I have. And it's something I grew up around. My mother was a novelist. And when I went to university, I studied literature and history, and I always felt that I would write and knew I would. And then I joined the Marines and spent 8 years going in and out of Afghanistan. And at the time, writing fiction and publishing just wasn't something that I felt I had the bandwidth to do while I was fighting the wars. But then I left and turned my energies towards writing fiction.
So was it that your mindset changed or your place and environment changed that let you do this?
I think it was a little bit both of mindset and environment. I think the environment when you're deploying in and out of the war zones and the pace of your life is such that not so much just writing, but writing and publishing. It's difficult to have the bandwidth, particularly for publishing. And additionally, there's space. I mean, a lot of the issues that I was getting at in my writing were things that I was very much involved in when I was in the wars. And, particularly for a novel like Green on Blue that's set in Afghanistan, I needed a little bit of space before I tried to take on the subject matter.
So Green on Blue, as you mentioned, takes us into Afghanistan. It takes us into a country that's in such turbulence. Tell us about this story and why you chose to go here.
Well, I started writing Green on Blue just a few months after my last tour in Afghanistan. And that was about 8 years after I left my first tour in Iraq. And, I felt really driven by a visceral need to tell Aziza's story, the protagonist of the novel. That story is one of imagination, obviously, but it's inspired by the men and friends I'd come to know when I was an advisor to Afghan soldiers. So at the end of those 8 years, I came back from my war, but these Afghan soldiers were my war buddies because I had been their advisor, and they weren't a bunch of guys that I could, keep up with on Facebook, call long distance, or get beers with at the local VFW. I mean, they were Afghan soldiers, and we've, fought together, bled together, more friends together, But you know, they remained in Afghanistan, and the conflict there is an elliptical one. And I knew I'd never see them again. They weren't going to be able to make it to the States. So upon coming home, you know, I was reckoning with the loss of those friendships. And in that vein, I wrote this book to try to illumine their world, you know, in the last act of friendship.
Elliot, do you want people in the United States and perhaps other parts of the world who might not understand the Middle East fully to learn something new by reading this book or understand something?
You know, well, I think the ambition of the book is to tell the story of the Afghan war at the micro level. You know, it's the Afghan war rendered in miniature. So I hope someone coming to the book will read it, will see Aziz's story, the protagonist, and see how he relates to the other individuals in the book, and understand a dynamic and a paradigm that exists in Afghanistan in many different locales, and frankly, transcends Afghanistan. And you know, if the reader takes away that knowledge, then I'd be very happy.
Was it difficult for you to write? And I guess that difficult goes to both emotionally and writing a novel, because I'm assuming it was a very new endeavor for you.
Well, I've been writing for a great many years before, you know, this novel was finally completed. So, it's difficult to pinpoint the moment when you begun a novel. As you can imagine, there are parts of this book that are ideas and even scenes that I've been playing with in my mind for years. But the process of writing the book, like any book, you're trying to pin down themes and present them in a way that are accessible and that hopefully make a connection with the reader. And that's always a little bit of a wrestling match.
Yeah, and a novel is just huge.
Sure, it is. But the only way to tackle it is to just go bit by bit every day until you get to the end.
There you go, bit by bit. And now you are on a wonderful tour that's really going to take you across the country. You're going to be in Boston and New Hampshire on the 24th, the 25th, the 26th. After that, you're going to Dallas and to Chicago and San Francisco and elsewhere. Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to on these stops?
I'm looking forward to meeting people who hopefully connect with the book. I think that's why we all write. It's writing a novel is a very intimate process. For years, you have an incredibly close relationship with the subject matter, and the point of putting the book out into the world is that hopefully readers will be able to share a similar intimacy with the subject. So, I'm hoping some of those connections will be made, and I look forward to meeting the people with whom the work resonates.
And how about these fabulous reviews, Elliot? Did you have any idea when you were writing Green on Blue that it was going to get the kind of reception that it has?
Well, you're hoping that people will respond to the work, and if people do, that's always very gratifying. So it's nice to see that that's happened in certain cases.
You're a very humble man.
Well, thank you.
So Green on Blue, as we mentioned, it's your first novel. Are you going to be working on another one?
I am. As you know, I live in Istanbul, and I've been there for going on about 2 years now. And I've been writing about the Syrian civil war for a variety of publications, but I've primarily been working on a novel that's all set on the Turkish-Syrian border. And so I'm in the process of finishing that book up.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds fabulous. So you really are taking us to different parts of the world and really offering us these looks into places that we wouldn't see otherwise.
That's what I aspire to do.
You know what? I love that. And one of, in addition to the show and being a journalist, I teach journalism as well. And perhaps it is the idealist in me that that always pops out. But I just think that that is such an important job, that, you know, using your abilities to tell stories and create this understanding that we just seem to have such a terrible lack of in the world today.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, fiction and storytelling is a powerful tool with which to build bridges between people. And, you know, ultimately these conflicts around the world, they may feel very distant to us. You know, these are conflicts that are being fought within the human heart, and, you know, and fiction, I think, is the most effective tool to map the human heart. And I think that a lot of these issues can be understood through stories.
Elliot, if you have to put on your marketing director hat and urge someone to buy Green on Blue, what would you say? Who should pick up this book?
You know, I think that the book could speak to anyone. You know, someone might look at Green and Blue and say this is a war novel, but, you know, to be honest, I've never thought of it as a war novel. I mean, not in the traditional sense. You know, the book, it's about family, friendship, betrayal, and, you know, and the choices we make where, you know, when doing right seems absolutely impossible. And, you know, I think those are themes that are recognizable for anyone who's sacrificed for what they love. And so, yeah, I hope people will take a look at the book, and I hope they connect with it.
Elliot, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you so much for doing this interview. I really appreciate it.
Elliot, this talented writer with a varied past, is in New England this week, appearing tomorrow, Tuesday, February 24th, at Tufts University. On Wednesday, February 25th, he'll be at the Harvard Bookstore, and on Thursday, February 26th, at the University of New Hampshire. Get the details at ElliotAckerman.com and win a copy of Green on Blue by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of Andrea Chapin's The Tudor. The Tudor takes readers back to the late 1590s and Elizabethan England, and it imagines William Shakespeare as a brilliant and brazenly flirtatious tutor who becomes involved in the life of a young woman named Catherine, along with the unrest caused by the death of Catherine's secret Catholic family priest. Inventive and absorbing, this historical novel casts Shakespeare in a light that's never been seen before. And it's written by a woman who, up until this point, really has focused her career on helping other people get their stories on paper.
I have been a book doctor, which is a private book editor, for over 10 years, and was at a point in my life where I was not working on my own fiction. I was working on other people's first novels and books and memoirs, and was also at that point regularly reviewing books for Moore Magazine, often 4 books a month, and was in the jury of the New York Public Library Literary Lions Award for several years, which would mean a big box of novels would arrive at my door, usually about 45, for novelists 35 and under, for a prize. And at this point, I was well over 35. And one Christmas, I had heard about a book called A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, 1599, by one of my in-laws who's in the theater world. And she was like, everyone's reading this book. You should read it. It's great. A nonfiction book looking at A Year in the Life of Shakespeare. And that Christmas, and this is a true story, I was buying books at my local Barnes & Nobles, and I saw the paperback of that book right as I was collecting my books, or right, it was actually almost close to where I was at the cash register. And so I said, I'm going to buy that book, wrap it up for myself, and put it under the tree. And this will be my Christmas present to myself. And it happened that Christmas, we didn't have to go to other family members' houses for Christmas. We were just going to have an afternoon. My husband was going to cook roast pork. My kids were going to play with their presents. And I indeed wrapped it up, put it under the tree Christmas morning. I opened it up. It's like, oh, thank you. And everyone was looking at me and my family like, you're a little weird. This is the present you gave yourself. and I started reading it on the couch that day. And it was, and anyone who's in the world of editing and teaching can understand, and writing journalism and deadlines can understand this. I hadn't at that point read a book that I wanted to read for a while. And with young children, I had read books that I needed to review. I had read books that I needed to edit. I read manuscripts. I had read books for the prize at the New York Public Library. But this was something for myself. And I had always been interested in Shakespeare. I don't think I had had I wasn't obsessed by Shakespeare. I had done a lot of acting earlier in my life, and I had acted in Shakespeare. I will have you know that in my fourth grade class at Oyster River Elementary School in Durham, New Hampshire, Mrs. Bassett had us put on Macbeth, and we built a theater in a round, and I played Lady Macbeth. And I will say that has informed the rest of my life. And so every time, and I know I'm digressing, anyone says, what's the right age to introduce children to Shakespeare? I always say, as early as possible, they get it. Anyway, I feel very strongly about that. My political.
I love that.
But anyway, I started reading this book, and it's a wonderful book by Professor James Shapiro, who's a Shakespeare scholar at Columbia University. And it talked about the lost years of Shakespeare, meaning the many years that there are no documents for him. We don't know what he's doing. And they have several groupings of lost years. And one particular group is the years that run from 1585 to 1592. We know that in 1585, his two twins were christened, because that they have documents from the local church, from the Holy Trinity Church in Stratford. And then we know he is mentioned in a sort of sarcastic quip in a penny pamphlet, which were pamphlets that were very inexpensive to produce and were passed around. And different poets and playwrights and writers would write. It was almost like a version of, I don't know, maybe, well, certainly blogs and online now, or maybe, you know, the Post or whatever, and the New York Post or something. But anyway, Robert Greene writes about this character, and who he calls Shakeshrafter. It's a wonderful quote, and I actually have it in the intro of my. And you can tell he's sort of poking fun at this guy who is a playwright and a player and thinks that he can do everything at the same time. This is the quote. For there is an upstart crow, beautified with our feathers, that with his tiger's heart wrapped in a player's hide, supposes he is as well able to bombast out a blank verse as the best of you, and being an absolute Johannes factotum, is in his own conceit the only shake scene in a country. Now, Johannes factotum is someone who thinks he can do everything. So that quote in something called Greene's Groat's Worth of Wit is assumed to be about Shakespeare, a tiger's heart wrapped in a player's hide. Now, a tiger's heart is not a mouse's heart. A tiger's heart is a fairly aggressive image. And I was captivated by the idea of what was Shakespeare doing in particular in these years, because I had worked with so many authors, and I also taught writing at NYU School of Continuing and Professional Studies for 10 years, worked with a lot of young, right out of college writers and older writers working on their first books. And as I sat on the couch reading this nonfiction book about Shakespeare, I came up with the idea of what if I were to write a book that dealt somehow with his lost years. So I started thinking about that. And as the months went on and I still hadn't written a word, I think, at that point, I began conceiving of a person not unlike myself, someone who has or who has worked with writers to get them their first books, their first agents, who sees them go off into a world and she is their muse, their coach, their teacher, you know, their psychotherapist. So little by little, I started writing. And when I started, I had done a tiny bit of research, but not a lot, because one thing that I felt was very important was that I got the characters and their dynamics on the page before I got overwhelmed by the wonderful history and the wonderful facts about this period. So I wrote the first 30 pages barely doing any research, just so I sort of, it was a way to make sure that I was invested in the characters and their dynamics and not overwhelming the reader with all the wonderful historical facts. And then as I pushed through and wrote the book, I did a tremendous amount of research really while I was writing the book. And that was so much fun. And I have now become obsessed with Shakespeare, have become obsessed with the Elizabethan period, like you mentioned you are, and have several books lined up afterwards that all take real life through incidents or people and intermingle them or intertwine them with fiction and fictional characters. And anyway, so that's how I started the book. And one of the hypotheses as to what Shakespeare might have been doing around this time was that he might have been a tutor or a part-time player. Players are actors, they called them players back then, for a very affluent recusant Catholic family. Now, recusant means a family who is still practicing Catholicism in a period, in a point in English history where that is basically illegal. We have Queen Elizabeth, who's very much a Protestant queen and very much enforcing the religion as a national religion that her father created, that Henry VIII created when he left the Catholic Church and wanted to get a divorce. So anyway, I took that idea, the documents, and it's a will in a Houghton. The Houghton family lives in Lancashire, and they still live in this wonderful estate called Houghton Tower. And I met with Sir Bernard de Houghton, the 14th Baronet, and he was a valuable mountain, sea of information about that period. And in one of his ancestors' wills, there is a line where the will gives several musical instruments to a William Shockshraft, and names and even regular words weren't consistent back then. There were many ways to spell one word, and you see that throughout in terms of last names, in terms of just the spelling of words. It was almost more phonics than a standardized English that came a bit later. And so they have that, the Houghton family believes that Shakespeare was in the employ of their ancestors, and in fact, probably one of his schoolmasters, we don't know for sure that Shakespeare was at the grammar school in Stratford, but we pretty much assume that he was. One of the heads of that grammar school went back up to where he was from, which was this area in Lancashire around Preston, and they think possibly he brought the young Shakespeare with him to be a schoolmaster, tutor, part-time player. That would have happened when Shakespeare was around 15, and another whole story, which I won't go into here, is when you look at his father's timeline in history, you see a man that was not just a Glover, but a man who was very ambitious and took on about seven roles in the town government and ended up being the mayor of Stratford. Most people go, how could Shakespeare be Shakespeare? His father was just a glover. Well, you see, and this is documented, what his father did in that town, and you see a very ambitious man, thus perhaps a very ambitious son. And at the time Shakespeare is around 15, something happens. The father tumbles. We don't know, is it because he is a Catholic? We don't know anything. We don't know why. There were fines for usury. He was lending money at a high rate of 25%. He was also dealing in wolves. There could be many reasons why there was this fall from grace. But so I took that idea of that around 15 that Shakespeare might have gone up to make some money for his home and maybe and for his household when his father tumbles, and I said it a little bit later. So I created my own recusant Catholic family, and I have created that Shakespeare has gone to London for a while, has followed players, become a player, an actor in a traveling troupe, and then comes back to this area that he had already been to when he was 15, becomes a tutor, fills in for the priest that has just been murdered, and that is how my book opens, and comes to finish his first poetry. So I sort of took some hypothesis and ideas and then created my own story out of them.
Wow. Wow. That's quite a story within itself. Now, tell me, Andrea, when you were working on other people's
yes.
books, did you always have the thought in the back of your mind, you know, gosh, why aren't I working on my own
yes,
book?
Yes, yes, and yes. And it was getting to this point where it was, I will say that it was definitely wearing on me that I hadn't. And this was something that I had wanted to do literally since I was 15. So it was always something, and I had worked very much in the literary world, and I had worked for literary magazines. I had gotten my, at 30, after working in what we call glossy magazines, I'd worked at several glossy magazines, Vogue and others, I went back and got my MFA in creative writing from Columbia University, and then worked in several literary magazines, and then became an editor of a theater, sort of literary theater magazine, and then had my first child and started doing book doctoring, and which I found out that I had a real knack for, and it was a wonderful combination of being able to make my own schedule and do something that paid money and something that I really love doing, and I still love doing it, and I still do it. I have two books on my desk that are I'm trying to get done before my book comes out. But it was on another level, I will say, that it was wearing on me. And so it was interesting. I think it's sort of a combination of at a point in one's life where I was open also. I will say, magical elements to writing this book and creating it. And I think that one of them was that I sort of opened myself up to give myself a present of this book that then went on to give me this idea to write this book. And once I had the idea, it was so interesting. I could not let it go. It was exciting, and yet I was not a Shakespeare scholar or a Renaissance scholar. I mean, during the course of the 6 years that it took to write this book, my children and my husband left because I just had books piled up around me, and I went back and I read Chaucer, and I went back and I looked at, I looked at Edmund Spenser. I read not the whole Fairy Queen, but a lot of it, and so it was a wonderful. If one is to have a midlife crisis, this is the one to have.
So how did it feel to finally be able to hold your work that you conceptualized and made a reality? How did it feel to hold that in your hand?
Like having a third child. So wonderful, and I still sort of pinch myself. And it's been really such a wonderful journey, and the reception has been wonderful, and I've felt very fortunate about that, and some great early reviews, which is really b- buoyed me. And I don't take anything for granted. And I also have been around the literary world and authors and editors and agents enough to know it's all hard. And it hasn't gotten any easier with the changing of publishing and how the whole world is changing in terms of the internet. So, at this point, everything that happens, I am very grateful for. So, that's my wisdom.
And who do you think, there's a certain type of reader that will enjoy The Tudor? Do you have to be a historical fiction lover to enjoy it?
I don't think so. I think that you can be. There is romance in it. There's definitely historical fiction, but also, and I've gotten, wonderful responses about this, that if you're interested in Shakespeare, I was fortunate as I was on this journey of writing this book to actually then meet James Shapiro, who wrote the wonderful book, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare. And he was so enthusiastic. I thought, here I am, a sort of lowly fiction, not yet completed or first novel writer. And he said, if I were a fiction writer, this is the topic I'd think of. This is a wonderful idea. Because I said to him, so happy to meet you. I got the idea of writing this book that I'm working on from your book. And he was just tremendously helpful in terms of anytime I was, where do I go in terms of this topic, or that I would email him and he would have a list of books for me to go to, and that was very helpful. And then Professor Shapiro read my book before, he actually read two versions of it, I mean two, not versions, but just the first draft.
The draft.
Oh my gosh, which was hundreds of pages longer than it ended up being, and I can't believe he waded through that. That was very generous. And then he wrote a wonderful blurb for the book. So I feel that it has a wide range. And one of the early reviews, the Kirkus review, said this is an audacious move by Chapin to try to recreate this moment in Shakespeare's life, but she makes it real. And I think what I tried to do is make the characters not distant, not arcane, not from another world, but human beings, and certainly the makeup of the house too, and Catherine, people that we know, the Kirkus also said, if you've ever sat around with a group of girls and they say to someone, how can you be, basically, what are you doing with this guy? And the woman responds, you just don't understand him. I mean, it's sort of, I wanted to make it readable in terms of the characters that they could be people now. That's, so it's not just in the historical sense, but that the characters feel very real and are involved in situations that we could be involved in.
Well, congratulations, Andrea. I think it's so exciting that this book is out there. We have to wrap things up, but can you tell us, I know that you're on Facebook,
yes,
and you have a website address
I do, and the website will be up and running. That's my final final push, and I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and the website is andreachapin.com, and that it's in the process, but it'll be up very soon. So,
Andrea, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Andrea, Elliot, and Holly for being on tonight's show. Thanks also to you for listening. This wraps up tonight's Literary New England episode. We'll be back again next Monday and hope that you will be too. Until then, have a great week and great reading.